Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hi, this is Martin from Backpage. You're used to hearing Graham Hunter asking the questions in the big interview, but you're about to hear an episode from another podcast, and this time he's on the receiving end. This is from Between the Lines, a podcast produced by Backpage that tells the stories behind great sports writing. This one features Neil interviewing Graham about his book Spain, the inside story of La Roja's historic treble. If you like this, there are lots of episodes to catch up on, including interviews with Simon Cooper, David Winner, Rory Smith, and many more. Search for Between the Lines on your podcast app and look for the green logo.
From Backpage, I'm Neil White, and this is Between the Lines, a podcast that tells the stories behind great sports writing. In 2012, Backpage, that's the two of us who produce these podcasts, published Spain, the inside story of La Roja's historic treble. It was the second time we'd worked with Graham Hunter, and today we also produce his podcast, The Big Interview. Some of you might listen to that. Back then, we were all coming off the back of his award-winning first book on FC Barcelona, the film adaptation of which comes out later this year. For his follow-up, Graham reflected on the unique access he had had to the Spain national team at three consecutive tournaments they'd won, Euro 2008 and 2012 and the 2010 World Cup. As Gerard Piqué says on the cover of this book, Graham was with the team every step of the way. On top of that, he went back to carry out new interviews with key players, opponents, coaches and staff members to bring to life a streak unmatched in the history of international football. The structure of the book is a huge part of its success. Around two profiles of the coaches, Luis Aragonés and Del Bosque, and chapters on key components of the team's success such as the Spanish FA's development strategy and the winning mentality that this group of players acquired at an early age, the spine of the story are three weighty day-by-day diaries from each tournament. Reading these for the first time, as Graham filed the chapters, I was transported back to these tournaments I had watched on television, except this time I had behind-the-scenes access and my guides were Marco Senna or Fernando Torres or Santi Cazorla or Del Bosque. The result is my favourite of all the books we've published at Backpage. I can't recommend it enough. Keep listening after this interview with Graham Hunter, and I'll tell you how you can buy it for a special price of just £5.99 direct from us at Backpage. So the idea is born off the back of the World Cup, but you're not writing it until after the 2012 Euros, right?
What I remember was that it didn't begin until the pain of writing and publishing for all of us, Barca. Now, that must have come out, I guess, in January 2012. So I would have said that we began to talk about the idea and prepare the idea for 2012. And when Spain, as reigning European and world champions, go to Poland and Ukraine and then win it, and with such an interesting contrast to South Africa in that, by this stage, there's a big controversy about, certainly outside Spain, do we like Spain, do we not? God, they pass it so much. All this control of the ball.
You almost forget that now.
What I do remember is being shoved onto Radio 5 in Kiev on the night of the final, And one of the guys I like, so that means it's either Mark Chapman or Pugach, saying to me, now, there are a lot of people in this country who say, and I remember saying, well, those people should have their television license and the televisions taken away forever. I was furious. And lo and behold, Spain go out and win that final 4-0. They rip Italy, who've knocked out England and Germany, rip them to shreds, play one of the most, you know, dramatic, interesting, thrilling European finals there's ever been, and they just show that when the other side doesn't want to, if the other side wants to dance, then it's Fred and Ginger. If the other side wants to kind of block and stifle, then Spain will just wear them down. So we had the idea to write a book about Spain's triumphs before, then it became three in a row, which had never been done. And you remember how evangelical I got about looking up stats to say, well, even the great German side of the 70s, Brazil didn't do this. And the more I investigated when we were thinking about writing it, when we looked at how in the old days the Germans won a European championship, which I think was four games, straight to the semi-final and then the final. Brazil's Copa America tournaments were shorter, the World Cups were shorter. Everybody had it easier. Until Spain. So it was certainly after 2012 that we believed that there was history in the making and it should be written.
The process with the Spain book started very similar to the process with the Barcelona book, which was you, in a series of meetings with Martin and I, like anecdotally just telling us these incredible stories that add kind of layer and layer and layer onto the stuff that you already know. And typically with you, it's the backstory. Like, I'm just thinking about the last podcast that me and you did, which was about the Clásico, which began with this flashback to the Paseo, the Guard of Honor, that Barcelona were forced to give Madrid in
2008,
which kind of, you know, lays the table, sets the table for a whole different conversation that we had in that podcast. And with both of these books, I feel like that's the starting point. It's like, okay, what do we know that, what do we know has happened? Spain have won these three tournaments. What's your idea of the origin of that? And it's like, well, 2008, and I'm not too sure about what happened before then. And so we flash back to the...
See, my idea of this is different from what you've just said.
Oh.
In that, you know, it's not that I don't think I'm not worthy or whatever, but what you and Martin both give is a sense of worth to words and stories. You've both seen me living, so I, for good or bad, I tend to accumulate stories or anecdotes or things because I'm a little bit, I tend to charge into situations and I like to be noisy and I like to have colour and I like things to be happening all the time. Now, I listened to Simon Cooper, I think, on this series and possibly David Winner.
Yes.
And brilliant. What strikes me is their clarity of purpose and organisation and starting by saying, here's a story I want to find out how to tell. Well, these things happen to me because of work and because I stretch things a little bit. I do things that either other people don't do or I shouldn't do sometimes. Things have always happened to me throughout my life. So to me, it's not like I don't feel the things I say have got worth, but like it's like a man in, I wish I could tell you his name, in Dad's Army, he'll open his jacket and he's got watches and stockings and whatever. Walker, is it? Let's say it is. And I kind of feel like, well, I remember something there, or this and that, next thing. Now, I talk to you two, and you're like, God, I didn't know that, or that's interesting, or that would make a good, or... And so you go, oh, you know, as somebody who's not a natural, as you've had to edit, natural author, and somebody for whom writing a book is if it's not torture, it's hard. I like the addictive nature of blank pages, writing something, seeing it turned over, starting again. So to be convinced that there's worth, that the story, I do have an idea of how to tell a story, but that the component bricks are actually worthwhile, that's something that publishers need to do. It's completely different, I guess, from publisher who says, Simon Cooper, you're a talented young author, off you go. Here's a prize, here's some money. Or, you know, Winner's very talented and he's got a driven idea about how to explain some of the epic, exciting, complicated things about Dutchness in football. And I'm different from that. Therefore, I think the credit goes to Backpage for going, all right, listen, we've had to listen to these stories so often. If we make you write them, maybe you'll stop telling us them.
That's the driver.
And therefore, that's what I... Well, you say that's the driver as a joke. That's what I remember as the driver. Because neither of you said to me, here's how to tell this. You just went, go ahead and write that.
I think when we have the sort of more general conversations at the start of a project like that, then you will just shoot off story after story after story, and it's important. I always, you know, I can remember conversations at the start of both books that we've done with you where you've been talking for, you know, like an hour uninterrupted, and at various points, like, me and Martin will exchange looks, like, it's on. You know, like, that's a chapter. He's just described a chapter of a book. And it happened in both cases. I remember, and we, you know, I want to talk about all the components of the book, because the way that it kind of developed even after we started working on it was really interesting. And I remember early on you were like, you had a red line about Louis Aragonés. You were like, this, no one knows about this guy. You know, the probably, if you say those two words in to a British football supporter, they're going to think about the allegations of racism.
Jose Antonio Reyes and Thierry Henry and that wrong thing that he said for a purpose that he thought at his age was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you were right, I think. I think, you know, if you did a family fortune survey at that time, you know, I do think that would have been the most common reaction.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I remember the first draft of the Aragonés chapter, which was probably one of the earlier ones that you filed, came through. And it was like reading, for someone who'd spent 10 years as a sports journalist and then followed the sport closely once we moved into publishing, it was almost all entirely new. You know, his history as a player.
That's something you've both surprised me with over and over again.
Our ignorance.
No, the fact that you can, not at all, that you can shine a light on something that I think must be known or hackneyed, or I fear lack of originality. I've always had a real dislike, and please God, let me not be like this. People listening to this who think, well, that is what you're like, then tell me, because I'll give up. But I used to watch and listen to a lot of people who worked in sports broadcasting or writing, and I used to think, that's recycled. You don't have first-hand knowledge. That's an inaccurate version of something. You're smaller than the story you're telling. And I fucking hate that so much, because this is probably the first thing that united the three of us. You two said to me, sport is gigantic, it's heroic, it's tragic, it's passionate, it's interesting, it inspires us. And too many sports books are, too many football books are trite or boring or cliche. And I was like, fucking, you're bang on. Because I hear football stories in my head like Wagner heard Valkyrie, and that's just fucking the truth. So when you consistently say, wait, that's not known, that's not understood, people haven't, that hasn't hit mass diffusion, whatever story it is, often it surprises me, and it unshackles me from a fear of being repetitive or boring or trying to infuse interest and newness in something I've seen or heard or think is established but isn't. And that's a big it's not just a big talent on your behalf, but it's been important to me that somebody can say, if you believe in us, if you bank on us, we're telling you that story still merits telling.
So you were pretty strong that you wanted to do an Aragonés chapter. It was brilliant. You wanted to do a chapter on Del Bosque, which was fantastic.
Both of which was kind of obvious. I mean, we shouldn't invest any magic in a analysis of a book where the two guys who won the trophies get a chapter.
Not necessarily, no. And we had, you know, there was a connection between the templates of your Barcelona book and your Spain book, you know, of those kind of focused profile chapters. So, you know, I agree that kind of made sense. But the other really big idea that you had right off the bat that worked brilliantly was the prologue chapter, which took us straight back to kind of the low point, which, again, when you think back and you look at it now, that kind of makes sense, that you're telling this glorious story of three consecutive tournament victories that had never been done, and that you want to start by saying, but looking back here, you know how this story is going to end. It wasn't always thus. But it wasn't always like this. You know, once we knew that this is the story that we're going to tell, did you straight away think to that? Did you straight away think, oh, you know what? Northern Ireland, that's the way in here.
Well, it began before Northern Ireland. I think it began in Sweden or wherever it was. They'd just been defeated. And telling the Northern Ireland story was important because it was a split in the atom moment whereby they'd failed dramatically in the European Championships, and everybody kind of thought, well, shit happens. Out in the group, unable to score, draws and one defeat, and I think everybody thought in Spain, nah, no big deal. They do lose to Northern Ireland in a manner which was extraordinary, because it was completely toe-to-toe. For all the things we learned about, because I sat with Terry Gibson for a long time in his house talking about the planning of what he and Larry Sanchez came up with, what the moat at Windsor Park was like, the fact that the Northern Ireland boys had been hauled over the coals by their own press for being out on the pitch the week before and they'd lost heavily in the game before. All these kind of things are interesting, but the way in which, I think Healy got a hat-trick, didn't he? If you look at the side that played that night, there's not a gigantic overhaul that happens to turn Spain into this side that, before they win any tournaments, they got undefeated from November 2007 until arrival in Austria in Innsbruck for June 2008. So going back to something like that was important. But it felt like a bad idea to start with a really big issue. It was a really big issue which was reported in the UK, but I'm aware that people might not have consumed it as voraciously. But when changing the entire way that a national team conceives of how to play football based on a new breed of talent, a new kind of man, and you can effectively click your fingers and make that happen between November 2007 and spring 2008, if England could have done that, literally completely change its concept of how to play and make it effective in a 6-month period, they'd be sitting with fucking three World Cups right now. Aragonés did something extraordinary. Now, he didn't craft Villa or Xavi or Iniesta, out of wood or stone. But what he did decide was that his point of view was rubbish, that his own point of view was that before he came in, he was like, we are the Furia Roja, we chase the ball, we harass the opponents. If we have to, we kick it long, we jump higher than them, we knock them over. The Furia Roja means red fury. And oh, fuck me. Look at David Silva. Look at Xavi and how he plays. Look what Iniesta can do. All change. People don't do that in life. Or if they do, people call him out, you're a fraud. And he just clicked his fingers and went, I've got a different idea now. And he shoved Raul out. And shoving Raul out was like saying to Gary Lineker, all you do is score goals. You're not good for us anymore. Didn't happen to Lineker, but exactly what happened to Raul. And therefore, that was something that I wanted to use as a counterpoint. The little men are clever. Little men can play. Keeping the ball is important. Luis Aragonés, a bull of a man, a bull of a player, something like an Alan Shearer of Spain's playing era, where he scored in the European Cup final in 1974. He was part of the squad in 1964 when they won the European Championship. The 1974 was Atleti, obviously. It's something like Shearer or Jeff Assel going, wow, man, all this stuff that I did. No. Change. Therefore, to me, the pitched battle that enveloped Spain, society, politics, television, fans, about Luis Aragonés against Raúl was a big story, but it wasn't. You can't start the book that way. You have to try and make people. What at least I tried to do was. Anybody who read it anywhere had to be able to remember a time when their national team had fucked up completely was being booed and jeered by their fans. So everybody hopefully would be able to at least empathise, and then you draw them into the story. So it's kind of handy that there were lots of interesting things to say.
Yeah.
It wasn't an act of fiction. I had a lot of good material to work with.
Brilliant.
So therefore, the start about the buses moving back, they're booing, they're rubbishing, whatever. Yeah. All I wanted to set up was this team that, like you said, won three in a row, wasn't just controversial, that the change wasn't just big, but their fans absolutely fucking hated them.
Yeah. But what you just said there about the material, I was wanting to ask you about the profile chapters on the two coaches and the other sort of standalone chapters as well. So that includes the youth system.
The kids are all right.
Kids are all right is the youth system chapter about the way the Spanish bring their young players through. There's a standalone chapter on...
The man with the moustache is Del Bosque, which was great. The man behind the moustache,
that is good. I was wanting to ask how you build those chapters, and when you were describing...
I didn't.
When you were describing the origin story stuff there about the angry fans, straight away I was thinking there's a snapshot of Aragonés getting confronted by angry fans, is it through a fence?
Yeah, and then Las Rosas, another, correct, yeah.
And then there's another one where he is getting completely fried on live TV and like a sort of Kilroy style debate show.
He signs up for that. That was so extraordinary.
But he
gets a chasing, but he goes, I tell you what, I've got to front this up.
Yeah. Did you know that those two things, specifically those two things, were out there for you to like look at, that they were like a matter of record?
I lived through them.
Right, you saw them at the time.
Yeah, I mean, this is why you had such a job to persuade me it wasn't known, because I felt that as a Brit abroad, kind of everybody must feel the same as me, and this must be interesting. So, all right, I didn't actually imagine that live daytime, because it was Kilroy's a mad example, but I suppose it's more that right stuff, or what was that one about Jerry
Springer.
It was a Springer. It was a real Springer kind of thing, because... The country hated the way Raul was being treated so much. Mm-hmm. I think it was something mad called I've Got a Question for You. And it was about 50 or 60 people randomly selected across the population. Mm-hmm. And they were there just to say, you're wrong because of this, and why have you done this? Right? And he stood there like, he was a guy who believed in it. He was old-fashioned, he was old. But he wasn't a great man for suit and tie. But because he was on TV and he was representing the Federation in a national scandal, he was there, bullish, and with a twinkle in his eye. And Aragonés, to me, was an iconic, interesting guy who fought off anxiety and depression and gambling, and was a bullish man who consumed life really voraciously and noisily, but was also old-fashioned as well. Anybody who's got six nicknames... Fuck me, he's got to be... To try and paint his side of the story well, to try and not let people think that football began in 96, 98, whatever, and that Aragonés was great beyond his ill-judged and wrong remarks to Reyes to try and motivate him about Thierry Henry. There's a bigger story to tell, a better story to tell, and an interesting story to tell. Therefore, to try and talk everybody through the Calvary... That massive change of faith, the way in which the hair shirt was worn in public for nearly 2 years, and the way in which despite him galvanising, changing the entire nature of Spanish football, he was going to be left without a contract at the end of year 2008. And I remember being at a coaches' conference in Vienna, just after 2008, when Del Bosque, who was coming in, and Aragonés, who was going out, were in the same building. Atleti, legend. Real Madrid, legend. Del Bosque with Fernando Hierro, Real Madrid, legend, as his minder and his friend. The two of them kind of skirted each other through the building. First floor, ground floor. Ground floor, first floor. Dining room, bar. Bar, dining room. And watched this go on, and I watched the two of them. So to come to the middle of the story... Like things that move me help me write well. And when Spain win the World Cup in 2012, and this Asturias Prize, which is kind of like a Duke of Edinburgh Award or whatever, but it's a national award, gets given to the Spain side for what they've achieved. And De Bosque picks out his, not his enemy, but they had a relationship like cat and dog. And he won't go up to collect this award from the then prince, now king, unless Aragonés comes up with him. That'll do for me. That's a story. That's brilliance. That's the human condition. I love that.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And that scene with the two managers of this historic treble dancing around each other in that hotel is another one that's described brilliantly in the book. So for these, you know, I'm thinking about the Del Bosque chapter as well, and anything else that comes to mind, that on the occasions where you weren't the camera eye, the occasion when you weren't there, what was your technique when you were building up the source material? Like, where were you looking? Or were there...
Technically, what's the technical device of building
exactly.
a book?
Or specifically this one, you know, when you're looking at... Well, if you're trying to paint a picture of Del Bosque from his playing career, from his childhood, because you talk about his father...
Well, I was able to interview him. It's a mix of answers. The questions I didn't ask during the tournaments, because... first of all, you know, at the tournaments, I got extraordinary access to the players and the manager. So things that happened there.
I think
that's the camera eye.
You're right. And don't forget where you were going. But I think you should explain what your job is at these tournaments.
Well, in two of them it's the same. But in 2008, I'm literally just a reporter tied by UEFA.com to Spain. I followed Spain and Brazil and Italy intimately in 2006 of my own accord for a Chinese company. But I've seen enough of Spain for UEFA to say, listen, we like your style, go and follow. And strange things happened. The media officer for, not the press officer for Spain, but the media officer, a fella who, you know, I don't like and doesn't like me, acted abysmal and got kicked out pretty early in the training camp in Innsbruck. Therefore, the organiser said, look, would you mind stepping in and doing his job, please? And then it turned out the Federation hadn't employed anybody to translate their Spanish press conferences. Therefore, the Austrians and Germans and the Brits and the Dutch didn't have a clue what was going on. Will you help? Yeah. So that got me behind the scenes. So I was invited in behind the press conference wall, meeting the players, meeting the staff, and that embedded me, and that was fine. At which point, the next tournament, they said, will you be a television producer? Will you help generate daily television content for the Spain camp, from the Spain camp and their matches, which comes as part of the multi-million pound investment that broadcasters around the world from Iran through Australia and Canada and Germany and Britain, anybody who buys into the World Cup has a central reservoir of stories, news, interviews, training footage, flash just off the pitch. And it means that every organisation that's covering the World Cup can fake that they're in every game, every training camp. They may send 20 people when they're in need, if they're a big broadcaster, is to have 60 people there. So our work gives them the resources, whether it's daily quotes, whether it's one-to-one interviews, whether it's features, training stuff. So that means you've got to be, certainly in World Cup 2010, we were travelling with the team. In some instances, we were in Team Hotel, and I think every day bar one, we got a one-to-one interview. We filmed promos with the players. I had to invent promos. So there's one where We throw the rug. It's a nice shot. Sitting in a chair like you and I are now. It's set up like a TV studio. Puyol said, "Yeah, I'll play ball with you." And so we get the cameraman, second cameraman, off shot to throw a rugby ball into Puyol from one side. He catches it, and he goes, looks at the ball, looks at the camera, and goes, "Some people tell me this is rugby country. I don't know anything about rugby." Throws it out of shot. It's caught in the shot. It's thrown the ball. He catches the ball. He said, "Football? Yeah, I know about that." Simple as that. Made up on the spot. It's not Pulitzer, but the player enjoyed it. It went out to the broadcasters. They could drop that into their... They were given little promos, little flash promos that they didn't have to work for, pay for. So that job was made all the more exciting by the fact that players said to me, "Yeah, okay, we know you, we trust you. We'll muck about with you a little bit." And that's the access. So you're allowed backstage. I was allowed into situations where I was chatting to Del Bosque and strange things happened. I was chatting to the Spain FA president, and that's how I got in the World Cup dressing room. I saw things, I saw players pissed out their heads and kept quiet about it because they were allowed to be in that state because they'd just beaten Portugal. And the colour builds. And also the groups of players that I saw these three tournaments with, and the subsequent ones, which weren't so much fun in 2014 and 2016, they're full of really interesting, funny, characterful people. So it made for good watching. And if you've got a brain for a story, you file things away. But when you're not a camera, I use that expression, but so I was the camera, I see, you know, I actually see myself, I don't know, 75% of the book. Other than that, we live in an age where everything's televised. You know, you don't have to ask what really happened there. You see it. Like when you talked about Luis Aragonés at Las Rosas, it's live on TV as a fan shouts out, "The old idiot, what about Raúl?" And he walks up to him and says, "What about Raúl then?" He said, "How many World Cups has he won? How many European Championships has he won? When did he play?" And he's barking at this
it's
guy.
It's like a movie. It's like a scene from a movie. It's
fabulous. So it's all there. And also, they are the majority of the personnel who are involved in these tournaments, and therefore our book, like to talk about football. They talk about football again and again and more and more and more. In Britain still, there's a fear of being caught speaking really openly about football by the participants, not necessarily by managers, who are more self-determining, who know they're always going to bounce into a next job. But footballers, while they're still in a career, in the main, don't like to be thought of as hoity-toity or talking too cleverly about football. And still, I think that many, many of those who speak best on TV or radio about football in Britain happen to be not by no means all. And then what you see is the British footballers retire and speak brilliantly on television and show that they've had that all along. Well, in Spain, it's not like that. There's a constant splurge of people talking about football, which is great background material if you haven't seen it yourself.
This remains my favourite of all the books that Backpage have published so far. And, I mean, for me, it really hinges around these three tournament chunks, which are all about the access that you've just described that you had. I mean, I think it's, if the book exists without you doing that job and having that day-to-day access, I'm sure it's a very, very different book. How did you start thinking about it in terms of those diarised day by days?
It's a terrible thing. It's a horrible thing to admit. I just wrote like I speak. It all came out in a splurge of not quite stream of consciousness, but maybe trickle of consciousness. And by the time you must have seen this before I changed it. It just was just a this tournament, that tournament, next tournament. Three great big lumps. Now, my memory is that I didn't get told this won't do. My memory, and it could be a faulty memory, and when people say this about something that matters to them, I always shout at the radio, the TV, "Why don't you remember? You idiot." Here I am. I think in a panic, just before I sent it to you both, I went, "Well, this won't do. How do I break it down? Days." I think it works. Listen, I suppose we're not here to be judged. We're trying to talk about the mechanics of making a book. So people like it or not, so I'm not being boastful, but I'm proud of very little in my working life, like proud, but I was quite proud of the Spain book. I liked it. I liked it like a little friend. which is about the best you can say when you do any kind of work. It was my little chum, and the diary thing worked. And it was a last minute panic mode to go like, oh, I don't think they'll like this. This is no fuck. All right, what? And I spent probably about 10 hours turning 3 great big chunks of copy into day by day. And I remembered it because I'd been at them. I had to check dates. And it's one of those things in life where, of all the parts of any book, it's the only part I found enjoyable. Turning 3 gigantic chunks of tournament into days.
How is that, like, natural? Because when we were doing the first pass on it, the first edit, one of the things that I just kept scratching my head at was your recall. I mean, had you kept a diary or...
No, the fuck. It's so intense. I mean, if you're...
It's so intense to what? It's so intense that...
If you're there and you're cheek by jowl with them, like, for example, I don't mean to make that sound stupid, because in many instances, I'm quite sure they wouldn't have even... For all the interactions we had, it's probable that some of them didn't even know I was there. Despite the one-on-ones, despite the, I need this from you now, can you help me? Yes, I'll help you, I trust you. Probably that's all just sawdust to them. But for me, it fucking wasn't. I need you, I need that now. Can I do this? Can I come with you? Can I see this? Or to my cameraman, who's brilliant. Adam was just brilliant, man. Get that, see that, go for that. All the news training I'd ever been given, or all the news instincts I'd ever had, maybe more news instincts than training. If you're at training twice a day, as we were, in the dark, with black South Africans, 70 or 80 of them, doing tribal chants, rocking back and forward, harmonising, and every so often all you can hear is the word chavi. And they're as colourful as anything you've ever seen in tribal or traditional South African garb. It's off the scale, it's nuts. You're breathing thin air, it's dark, it's winter in summertime, you're cold. At night, you have to wear every single piece of kit that the host broadcasting service have given you to make you look like a blue smurf. Like all your socks and your gloves and your hat, because in the bed and breakfast we're staying in, they don't have central heating and it's bastard fucking freezing. And then you get up and work, first thing in the morning, you prepare for training, you film training, you watch, you try and see the story, look at the tactics. Who's missing? Well, then he has to be back. Why is he stretching? The Bosque, look at Capdevila. How can Capdevila, with Albiol, defend 2 against 4, and with Pepe Reina ordering from behind, how can he... it's heaven. How the fuck are you going to forget any of that? But then you're working, you're recording, you're editing, you're sending, you're picking through facts. Your instinct sometimes as well, totally against the rules, maybe I'd be broadcasting or I'd be writing for newspapers. So the stuff that already was indelible, I might be... getting down in written form in order to earn freelance hardens it. If you're given something that you're able to realise is the experience of a lifetime there and then, it's like branding cattle, man. It's on my skin forever. I mean, it's the closest thing you'll ever come as a journalist to winning it yourself. To like them too. I don't know how much you need to like people in a working project in order to make it, to elevate it. There's thousands of examples of records or films or books where the protagonists have fucking hated each other, and that makes it all the more special. For me, all I want to do in that situation is win and beat the other person. In this situation, all I wanted to do was to never get in their way, but to try and chronicle what I thought might be I was more sure in 2008 than I was in 2010. Absolutely. I worked with a guy by my side in 2008, Danny. Hola, Danny. Before every game, I said to him, don't even think about this. They're going to win this. And win this game, they're going to win the tournament. It wasn't like that in 2010. I wasn't so sure. I and the nerves, and the nerves against Chile in the third group game and Paraguay in the quarterfinals. Not against Germany, I just kind of believed. Holland, I was just overwhelmed. I couldn't breathe, never mind think. Not against Portugal, I was quite sure there. Not against Honduras, I was certain there. The Switzerland thing was just like, how the hell has that happened? So I tried to make your and Martin's job less onerous. So I did try to be faithful to my memory of a detail that betrayed me here. So I did check, but it was, you know, it was, I knew as it was happening, this is, I probably don't deserve this, is the truth. Just like, and I asked myself, how did I get here?
Putting the book together, I mean, like, because Backpage really is just Martin and I, and for these two books, it was kind of Martin and I and you, and it's the whole thing's a big, big collaboration, even when it comes to sort of dressing the book. So you were helping us source the pictures if you knew whether, you know, if you knew a snapper that was at a particular game or something like that. For those of you listening to this who have perhaps read Graham's book on Barcelona, we had worked with an illustrator called Dan Layden for that book, and we got in touch with Dan again. So we came up with we liked the idea from Barcelona of that each chapter would have its own front page with one of Dan's illustrations. So I think for this one, I remember he did a great job with the two coaches, big full page sort of portraits of them.
We pored over those and disputed and refined and whatever, because I think they're a process of both artistic interpretation and hard work too.
Mm. And then the three front pages for the pivotal tournament diary sections of the book ended up being these kind of wonderfully themed images of the Spain team bus and then something that talked to each location, which worked brilliantly. And Dan, I'm pretty sure that Dan, who you can reach out to on Twitter, is a great, you know, sports specialist, artist and illustrator now. But that looks good. And then we came up with this idea as like a sort of postscript at the back of the book of just having something that you sourced, which was the stand-up, what would you call those? The kind of like cigarette card.
I'm not one for being concise, but I remember the chapter pictures in both books stemming from the idea of us all going like, God, Sting was good, wasn't it?
That's right.
And every chapter in the Sting starts with a little illustration, horses or a gamble
that then melts
or whatever it might be. And I remember the idea for the pen pictures at the end from being Dad's Army.
You have been watching. Or any sitcom, I mean.
I think we all, apart from, it's been too much of me talking, too much about the words, because the point about constructing a book was we collaborated a lot, we argued a lot, we refined a lot. For example, in the Barca book, Up to the Whistle, we were rejigging chapters, not changing our mind, but refining it constantly. And I think to some degree, there was refinement going on in the Spain book, and you guys said, I tell you what we'll do. We'll do the, you know, meanwhile, back in Gotham City.
That's right. Oh, my goodness. That was in
little chunks of what else is happening elsewhere in the tournament.
Those were within the diarized tournament sections. We just had these little blocks.
Because at a tournament, what's worth explaining to people is that if you're as intensely embedded in one successful nation, particularly at a World Cup, not so much at the European Championships, you end up not seeing a great deal of the rest of the tournament.
Right.
You see bits. Mm-hmm. But you don't see an awful lot.
And in this book, I think the reader experience, it does help for them if they're reading the Spain story from, let's say, year 2008. I think it really does help them to say, okay, so at this point, this other thing was happening. At this point, Germany were winning this match. I remember that. You know, I remember that goal. I remember that team going out at that point. I remember that red card.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really worked.
And the reader, actually, generally, is more informed about that than I am or my equivalents are.
Right, that's interesting. So let's talk about the reader. I mean, since publication, how has this book kind of come back to you? You know, what sort of feedback, if any of you?
It hurt a lot that it, you know, it didn't do the same numbers as Barca, because my opinion was, again, in the minority, as it very often is. I thought it was a better book. It made me happier. And, you know, it sold. But I thought that it probably merited more. Now, in the end, it got explained to me, particularly by Martin, who said, you know, it did numbers up into... So that would be the first piece of feedback. I suppose in musical terms, it'd be the difficult second album. Except the only difficult thing wasn't about the creation or the harmony about doing it, but like, it didn't go platinum. And then beyond that, I can't, you know better than me.
Well, I know that, put it this way, I know that you've had, I know that you, you know, you had a lot of feedback off the back of Barca, which is an incredibly popular book.
The football industry read Barca a lot, which is interesting. It was meant for them particularly, but I think we all found that. So people certainly admitted to having read Spain and liked it. That felt good. But it's rare I do work, irrespective of having, you know, top quality guidance, support, initiation, editing, publishing, whatever, from you two. It's rare I do work that I look at it and go, I'm quite pleased with that.
Yeah.
So that is how I felt about the book, and that, maybe that's my feedback. I think it represented them properly. In both books, I had a tremendous worry about not doing justice to the people who are the protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're writing fiction, I think you can do justice to the protagonists because they're yours. Well, I was just a chronicler. I wasn't even Spanish, which I think helped. I don't think... some of the Spaniards who wrote about the tournaments had greater access, because while I've got some of the phone numbers of the players, they had most of them, or they were... The players who play for the bigger clubs depend a lot on the goodwill of particularly radio and television in Spain, and therefore the Spanish press can do a good job of chronicling. I tend to disagree with their opinions a lot, because they're very... parochial, or they're one-eyed, but in actually gleaning details, it's good. Without being presumptuous or arrogant, I think an outsider looking at it probably give a sufficiently different summary of the process to be able to, I think, represent it better personally, and therefore I I've never ever kept a diary in my life. I know that it's something. When you're an individual who goes away for so many weeks, that summer felt like forever, felt super tiring. I think I was away for 7 or 8 weeks. People do much, much more than that, but it felt a long time for me away from my family. Therefore, to eventually make a book, which I think stands the test of time and was honest and accurate and entertained some people, it makes those summers spent away feel a little bit more worthwhile. So for that, I suppose, I owe you and Martin a little thank you.
Oh, no, we're even, at least.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation, the latest in our World Cup series, more coming soon. If you've never read Graeme's book on Spain, you can get it direct from us for a limited time at a very special price of £5.99 plus postage and packing. Go to mybooksource.com and click on the cover of the Spain book. Then, at checkout, use the offer code SPAINWC18. That's offer code SPAINWC18 at mybooksource.com to get this great book for just £5.99.
Thanks for listening to Between the Lines. If you like this, there are lots of episodes to catch up on, including interviews with Simon Cooper, David Winner, Rory Smith and more. Search for Between the Lines on your podcast app and look for the green logo.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.